We're doing Tanya 200, and we're up to chapter 28 in Tanya. Before we get into the meat of chapter 28, let's complete the subject covered in chapter 27. We spoke about the sadness that a person might feel over the fact that his condition in the present is an unholy one. Not past sins, but an unholiness in attitude and in thought. So that unholy impulses appear as thoughts in his mind, and he shakes them off because he is not a sinner, so he doesn't pursue the unholy thought, but he is saddened by the fact that they occur. The Tanya says that that sadness is invalid, it's illegitimate, and it comes from arrogance. There are saintly people who don't have unholy thoughts, but they are saintly. The average person is not created that way. The average person is created with unholy impulses, which he cannot control. They are involuntary, and his job is to refuse the unholy thought and thereby subdue the unholiness in the world in general. The truth is that even completely innocent impulses, when they are refused, when they are disciplined, brings about a great release of godly energy in the world. So that, for example, delaying or refusing a conversation that is tempting, not a sinful conversation, not slander, not lies, not gossip, an innocent conversation, and yet you simply refuse to say it because you don't want to indulge that impulse. Even more so with a thought, even the most innocent thought, if you discipline even the most innocent of impulses, it creates a great release of godliness into the person and into the world. Now, in general, a human being is different from the animal in that the human being is thoughtful, whereas the animal is instinctive. And therefore, a human being should get into the habit of being thoughtful about all behavior, not only the philosophical, the religious, and the academic. But even the most common behavior should, in a human being, be thoughtful behavior. Even sitting down to a meal should not be instinctive or habitual, it should be thoughtful. What am I about to do? What am I doing? Why am I doing it? How should it be done? When should it be done? And so on. Always thoughtful, never instinctive. That puts you into the category of human. That puts you into the realm of the human. Beyond that, we also want to move into the realm of the godly, of the goodness. And so when we discipline, by being thoughtful, all of our impulses, we are becoming a true mensch, and we're entering into the realm of godliness because we're giving everything a godly purpose. The Talmud tells about the eating habits of the sages, and it says that while most people would eat at around 8 o'clock in the morning, the sages would eat around 10 o'clock in the morning, 2 hours later than the average person. And of course, it wasn't to gain 2 hours of study time, because they studied all day anyway. So whenever they would eat breakfast, it would leave them with the same amount of time for the studying. So what was the purpose of eating 2 hours later than everybody else? The purpose was simply to discipline their appetite. And so if we delay eating when we are ready to eat, and we delay it 5-10 minutes, simply because we want to be thoughtful about it and not instinctive about it, that is a great accomplishment in the subduing of the unholy and in the releasing of the godliness in the world. And so, by fulfilling this commandment of sanctifying ourselves with the permissible, which means disciplining even our permissible and innocent impulses, this is fulfilling a positive commandment where the Torah says, make yourself holy. Make yourself holy means you're not a holy person. You do have instincts. You do have even unholy instincts. But make yourself holy. Behave in a holy fashion, which means in a thoughtful fashion, as if you were not a slave to your instincts. And slowly, at least to some degree, we do free ourselves of that enslavement, and our behavior becomes more human and less instinctive. And by telling us this, the Rebbe is adding another reason that we should not be saddened by the occurrence of these thoughts or impulses, but in fact, we should be happy. Because as long as we are successfully refusing the impulse, we are fulfilling a negative commandment, not to be misled or tempted by the impulses of our heart. That's the negative commandment. And then there's the positive commandment of make yourself holy with the permissible. By being thoughtful even about the permissible, we are fulfilling that commandment of making ourselves holy. Now, all of this applies to the feeling of sadness if it occurs during workday activity. What about the sadness occurring when we're trying to study, or we're trying to daven, to pray, and have proper intentions in our prayers? So when we're trying to serve God, and this sadness occurs, how are we supposed to rid ourselves of it? Here, it's not enough to say, you have no reason to be sad. It's wonderful that you have these unholy thoughts and you successfully refuse them. That's fine during the day. But when you're trying to fulfill another commandment, the commandment to study or the commandment to pray, it is not much of a consolation to say, well, you obviously can't concentrate on your prayer or on your studies, but at least you're fulfilling the commandment of refusing the impulses. There's got to be a better reasoning. There's got to be a better argument to reject this sadness. And so in chapter 28, the Rebbe tells us that even when the sadness occurs during the time of service of God, a person should not be saddened by it. Instead, he should dismiss it, ignore it completely, and put more energy into his study or into his prayer. And what is the reasoning? There are those who would argue that if you're trying to study or pray, and instead you're experiencing unholy thoughts, it's an indication that your intentions in praying are not sincere. Because if you were really into the prayers, then you wouldn't have these unholy thoughts. The Rebbe says that argument is not correct. It would be a good argument if we had only one soul. So the argument would go something like this. You've got one soul. You have one consciousness. If this consciousness is engaged in prayer, it wouldn't also be capable at the very same time of thinking of unholy thoughts. So if you're paying attention, if you're concentrating on one subject, you wouldn't have thoughts of another subject entering your mind at the same time. Because one soul can only be in one place at a time. So if it's having unholy thoughts, obviously you're not here. You're not in the prayer. You're someplace else. And that, of course, is a saddening thought. But the truth is that we have two souls. Not only do we have two souls, but that the two souls are in a contest with each other. When one is strong, the other is upset, and therefore tries harder. So when a person is really concentrating properly in his prayers, that's when the unholy impulses will be the most intent on injecting something unholy into the thought. So the fact that the unholy thoughts are occurring in the time of the prayer doesn't mean that the prayer is insincere or invalid. On the contrary, the more sincere the prayer, the more likely there will be an unholy thought. And so you have to compare this to two people rather than one person. You've got two people. One guy is trying to pray, and the other guy, who is wicked, is trying to distract you from the prayer. Well, what would you do? You wouldn't argue. You wouldn't sit there thinking that the suggestion is unholy and ugly and vulgar, and try to convince the other person that his suggestion is distasteful, because then he has succeeded, since his purpose is to distract you. And so the solution is, of course, that you ignore it completely, make like you don't hear, and put all your effort and all your energy back into the subject, back into the prayer. Now, what if that's difficult? What if ignoring the thought is not so easy, and the thought is insistent, and you can't shake it off? The Rebbe says that the solution is to turn to God for help. Don't try to argue your way out of this. Don't try to elevate the unholy thought. The Rebbe uses some strong language. Don't be a fool and try to elevate the unholy thought. Ask God to help you get rid of it. Elevating the unholy thought is mentioned in the holy writings, that when a person has an unholy thought or impulse, there's always an attribute that is the source and the nature of that thought. So, for example, you can have a hateful thought. Obviously, that's coming from the severity of your soul, the attribute of judgment. You can have an unholy, loving thought, but vulgar, and that's obviously coming from the kindness attribute of the soul, only it's unholy. So there's a suggestion in the holy writings that instead of just rejecting the thought completely, salvage the energy, take the attribute, the severity, the judgment, or the kindness out of the thought, and preserve that, and get rid only of the unholy form that it has taken. So if you have impulses that are unholy, the impulse itself is neutral. It's neutral energy, only it has taken on an unholy form. Get rid of the form, but save and salvage the energy itself. The Rebbe says, don't be a fool, and don't try to do this. Because that exercise was meant for the saintly. There are saintly people who do not experience unholy thoughts from their own heart. The heart of the saintly person doesn't have unholy impulses, and therefore it does not produce unholy thoughts. However, in the presence of others, when others are experiencing unholy impulses or unholy thoughts, the saintly person who is sensitive will pick up those thoughts. To them, it is suggested that rather than just ignore it and tune it out, retrieve the energy of the thought and reject the unholiness of it. And they can do this because the thought is not coming from them. But if a person is experiencing their own unholy thoughts, which means their heart and their mind is in this unholy place or unholy condition, so that it is producing the unholy thought, what does it mean to salvage or to elevate the energy of the thought and get rid of the unholy form? Where can such a person elevate the energy to when he himself is producing the unholiness. So he is not himself holier than the thought. He can't fix the thought. He can only wallow in it. And so the Rebbe says, don't argue with an unholy thought, because you're simply spreading the mud. You're just dirtying yourself more by arguing or debating the unholy thought in your mind. Reject it completely. Don't engage in it. Not even in arguing against it. Dismiss it completely, and if it's hard to do, then in your mind, during the prayer when you're not allowed to speak, but at least in your mind, ask God to assist you in getting rid of this unholy thought so that you can concentrate on the prayers. And God will do this for his own sake, not because we are deserving, but because the godly soul that is trying to pray is a little piece of God, and for his own sake, God will assist the godly soul and release it from this distraction so that it can pray properly. The nature of this battle between the godly and the ungodly, between the holy and the unholy, is an essential principle in the teachings of Hasidus and in the lifestyle of Hasidus. And this will serve as an introduction to chapter 29 as well. Speaking of the battle between good and evil, the Tanya describes not two impulses, the evil impulse or the good impulse, but two souls, a natural soul or animal soul and a godly soul. The godly soul is about God. The animal soul is about us, is about the person. In describing the animal soul, earlier on in Tanya, the Rebbe says, the animal soul is an unholy soul, and it is the soul that is present in the blood in our body that gives life to our body. Then he goes on to describe the unholy characteristics such as arrogance and anger and laziness and so on that is produced, which are produced by this unholy soul. But the first statement that Rebbe makes about the unholy soul is that it is in the blood and it gives life to the body. And this is what the Torah refers to as the spirit of the flesh. The spirit of the flesh means that soul which is in the blood, which gives life to the body. But why is that a description of unholiness? What's unholy about giving life to a body? So we see from this that the Hasidic definition of holy versus unholy is very different from the conventional definition. Unholy means that which is aware of itself rather than that which is aware of its creator. So godliness means seeing ourselves, identifying ourselves as an aspect of godliness. We exist in the service of God. So we identify ourselves with godliness and with God. That's the godly soul, the godly personality. The unholy, that which conceals the holiness, that's why it's called the husk or the shell, is simply an awareness of self. This awareness of self, this having an identity of our own, that's ungodly, that's unholy. And it expresses itself in practical terms in the way that we serve God. How do we see ourselves? How do we perceive ourselves? Is it that I am I have a life to live, I have an identity, and it's me, I am me, and I have choices? The me can either engage in unholy activity, it can engage in neutral activity, or it can engage in godly activity. And if I choose to be good, I will engage in innocent activity. If I choose to be godly, I'll engage in the performance of the commandments. And if I choose to be totally indulgent, then I'll engage in unholy or in sinful activity. But it's about me. And if I choose to serve God and devote my entire life, day and night, to the service of God, it's me serving God. So it's about me. That's called ungodly. Godly means God is the reality, God is what it's all about, and I am merely a part of that. I am merely one aspect of this godliness that is going on in God's creation, in God's plan, and in God's commandments. So when I fulfill the commandments, it's not a person, it's not a me serving God, it's godliness, being godly. So there aren't two separate things. There aren't two realities. There's only one God, which means one reality. Not a reality of the human being in the service of a godly reality. Because then we really have two gods, two realities. In this struggle between the godly soul and the animal soul, we don't necessarily have to involve any kind of sinful or criminal behavior. The struggle is not about sins. The struggle is about reality. The struggle is about identity. How do we identify ourselves? How do we orient ourselves? Do we perceive two realities with all the good intentions of serving a godly reality by doing what he says? Or do we perceive only one reality? There's only God, his creation, his plan, his purpose, his will, and human beings are simply part of that. And even the fact that we have freedom of choice is not because we have a personality of our own and a reality of our own, but because it suits God's purpose that human beings have free choice. So it's all part of his reality, because there is only his reality. Those are the two life conditions that we have when we have two souls. So it's not just a good mood versus a bad mood. It's not an evil twist to our thoughts and feelings versus a moral twist. It's not a mood, and it is not an experience. It's not a moment of goodness or evil. It's two complete lifestyles. It's two complete identities, two complete realities. So the very fact that a person eats because he needs to eat, that is, in Hasidic language, ungodly. It's an impulse that exists independent of godliness. So when a person eats simply because it's time to eat, or simply because he's getting hungry, without any further thought, without any further justification, that's living within a certain reality. When nature has its own dictates, when a person goes about his business in a certain way, simply because that's how the business works, this is the amount of time you have to invest, this is the kind of deal you have to make, this is the kind of schemes that you have to pursue in order to succeed in this business, there are a set of rules, almost another religion, that is vying in reality with the godly reality. And so if a person mindlessly follows the dictates of appetite for food, or the dictates of the habits of business, then the reality that is dictating his behavior is not godliness. So there is another God or another reality that denies the oneness of God. And so when a person is experiencing this tug of war, even if it's between eating permissible food, but doing it now, immediately, versus delaying it for the purpose of disciplining the impulse. Here you have the entire struggle between the godly and the ungodly. And we don't need to introduce sinfulness in order to exercise that freedom of choice. And so the battle is a much more noble one. It's not that we stand always on the threshold of sin and we're balancing precariously between the permissible and the forbidden. That's already an unfortunate place to be in. We don't need to be there. We need to struggle between godly and ungodly, even in the permissible, which is a more noble, a more elegant struggle between me being me first or God being God first. And that's called godliness versus unholiness, not good versus evil. That's a much lower contest. The subject that needs to be covered now, in addition to sadness, is the experience of complacency, which the Rebbe calls Timtum Halev, the plugged heart. Sadness means a lack of feeling that comes from a heaviness of the heart. Complacency is also a lack of feeling, but it comes not from a heaviness, but from a smugness, from a contentment, from having reached a plateau and not being able to kick yourself into the next level and activate more energy to get you to the next level. And this we will cover in the next chapter.